Hi, I'm Monica Hallan, and this is my podcast, Let's Talk Money. Every Friday, a new episode will drop that gives you a snapshot analysis of one money-related topic that has meaning in your life. And then I answer your money questions. My hope is to put you on the path to financial stability and freedom. So, let's talk money. Today, I'm going to dig into a really sensitive topic, our kids and what they cost. But first, I want to talk to you about mutual funds. A most common question I get is, Monica, tell me 5 funds to invest in. And you know, my answer always is, I will not. I will not because I know that the person asking this has not understood mutual funds and is just looking for a short-term punt. And that's not mutual funds at all. So what are they for, you're asking? Okay, let's first understand what is a mutual fund. Essentially, a mutual fund is just a pipe that connects your savings to a bunch of securities, like stocks and bonds. Let's just stay with stocks first and imagine each stock to be like a bead. Imagine that there are thousands of beads in this market. You can buy a few beads from the entire market because you have limited resources. Some of these beads will turn out to be precious and will make your money double or triple. Some will be semi-precious and will give you a good profit. Some will be just wood, your money just comes back, and others will turn into sand in some time and your entire money is lost. How will you choose these 5 beads out of the thousands out there? Can you examine each bead? You don't have that kind of time. Do you have the expertise, the discerning eye to evaluate the intrinsic value of what looks like a shiny bead but might just be covered sand? Let's suppose you do some of the homework and you choose 5 of the beads and you spend a lakh. But a year later, you find them all turn into sand. Your 1 lakh rupee has become zero. What if some of them turn out to be precious and your money doubles? What if some are precious, some are not? You know, the success and failure of this approach looks more like a game of chance than anything we can predict. Now let's take the game up a notch. What if you hired an expert to do the bead picking? You pay for his services, including costs of buying and selling, and this expert now maintains your bead portfolio. But when you hire an individual expert, it's going to cost you a lot, and you may not be able to afford such a person. So it's the cost that you are unable to pay. Now imagine if there were 100 investors like yourself and you got together, you pooled each your 1 lakh and you made it into a large pond of money, and now you hire one expert to manage this entire corpus. You will give this expert some rules of the game that she must follow, and collectively you will oversee that she remains true to the game. So all of you have now got together, hired an expert, and you have pooled your money. You will evaluate her performance year on year. And if you find that she does not deliver the kind of return that you want, you will fire her and you will get a better bead picker. The per person cost will be very small compared to hiring an expert all by yourself. Now let's take the game up one more notch. Imagine that a lot of people in the market were doing it, and some of the bead pickers, some of these experts, ran off with the investors' money. Now the government comes in, the regulator comes in and puts in some rules of the game. Now there's a way for you to buy the beads collectively, together with other people, using a regulated way that has an oversight of rules and regulations of a marketplace. That would not just reduce your costs, but also provide safety against fraud and somebody vanishing with your money. Remember that the judgment of the expert may never be 100% right. But because she has a large amount of money, she's able to diversify or expand her bead collection to at least 30 to 50 beads, up from the 5 that your 1 lakh could afford. Now, even if some beads turn to sand, the overall loss is diluted. Remember that the overall profit also gets diluted, as some beads do well, the others don't do as well, and some are complete duds. Your risk goes down because now you hold a varied set of beads that should give you an overall good profit. I know it's a very, very simplistic way of looking at how the mutual fund industry works. But you know, just replace beads with stocks and bonds And now you begin to get a mind picture of what the whole story is about. You begin to understand that a mutual fund is simply an investment vehicle that you use to buy stocks, bonds, gold, real estate, and combinations of these. It collects money from investors, offering to invest it in a certain way. Your investment destination could be an equity scheme that wants to invest the money in a large cap, in small caps, in mid caps, in foreign stocks. You could give a wall-to-wall mandate to the fund manager to do whatever the fund manager wants with the aim of generating a good return. You could want to invest in bonds that are maturing in 3 months, bonds that mature in 1 year or even longer tenors. You may want to invest in bonds which are risky. So remember that these are market-linked products, that they do not give a guaranteed return. The mutual fund is not a destination itself. It's a vehicle which carries your money to that end product that you want, which is, as I said, whether it's a large cap, mid cap, small cap, bond, combination, whatever it is that you want, the mutual fund industry has a product to take your money there. Again, go back a bit and remember what I have said earlier, that your savings that you do, which is an excess of your income over expenses, remains savings unless you turn it into investments. The way that you turn it into investments is through debt products, through equity products, through real estate and gold. A mutual fund is this intermediary which takes hold of your savings and allows you to invest into the different asset classes through the structure it brings to the market. It forms a link between investors and the market, which has stocks, bonds, gold, real estate. A key benefit that you get is diversification. What does that mean? Basically, you are able to hold 30 to 50 stocks in a single mutual fund. Whereas had you gone to the market yourself, you may have only been able to buy 5 stocks. But now you get the benefit of diversification. There is plenty more to understand. And I'm hoping that you send me your questions, which I can answer in a subsequent podcast. And now on to questions. May, we are dealing with a bit of a touchy topic today. Kids, whether to have them, what it costs, and what is the cost of delay in our having kids. What do you have, May?
Nishi from Mumbai asks this. I work in a new media company and I'm 32. I'm not married, though my partner and I have discussed it. Whatever our decision, I realize that my window for having a baby is running out. There's a lot of talk amongst my close friends who are all alpha career women that we can defer the decision to have kids by freezing our eggs. I'm not sure if that is something viable or the risks, if there are any. What does something like this cost anyway?
Nishi from Mumbai, your question got me to go down a very deep rabbit hole. I actually ended up speaking to an IVF specialist in Delhi, Dr. Richa Katyar, who educated me about the costs and the process of this issue. Typically, what she told me was that in her experience, most single career women go into the process of freezing their eggs, and the age group that they decide to do that is mid-30s to early 40s. But she finds there are cases where married women too want to freeze their eggs. And freezing eggs is essentially a process where eggs are harvested and they are frozen for future use when the woman and her partner decide to have a baby. She said that, you know, a woman produces 2 to 4 million eggs in her entire reproductive cycle. And it's only one egg every month that actually is available for fertilization. But in this process, some 50 to 200 eggs partially grow and are lost. They die out. An egg freezing technology basically uses hormones to grow other eggs enough in size so that the aim to harvest at least 6 eggs in a cycle is fulfilled. And the process is like this. The woman undergoes 2 hormone injections a day, and there's an ultrasound every 5 days, and this goes on for about 10 days. Then, transvaginally, 7 to 10 eggs are harvested. The process to harvest the eggs is a day process under general anesthesia. What I found out is that sometimes because of stress, because of the age of the woman, the quality of the eggs is not that good. So sometimes they have to go in for 2 rounds of the process I just mentioned. These harvested eggs are now frozen in liquid nitrogen and they can last for almost forever. What Dr. Katyar said is that they're frozen in both time and space. Now, at a later date, when the woman wants to use them, these are unfrozen and through the IVF process planted back in the woman's uterus. Costs, that's an important part. The process to freeze the eggs costs around 2 lakh rupees. And you need to think of another 40,000 a year to maintain the frozen eggs to pay the fees for this. And another lakh for the IVF process. So look at this 3.5 lakh rupees as a baseline cost. It depends on the kind of medical facility that you choose. And of course, in the future, there'll be the inflation of this cost. So you're looking at a baseline cost of about 3.5 lakh. What Dr. Katyar said is that the earlier you decide to freeze your egg, the better it is. The egg producing capacity of a woman suffers with age, with modern living, stress, pollution. Late 20s to early 30s is an ideal age. And like I said, you go down so many rabbit holes. Till what age can you do that? Now, the Indian law has put a limit to the age at which you can have an IVF treatment, and that is till 50. So beyond 50, a woman cannot get pregnant through the IVF process. That's simply because the lawmakers thought that the longevity of the parents has to be such that the kids are of an age that they can look after themselves, knowing that the average age in India is about 72. An interesting story I found out about this process is that this idea of egg freezing gained ground globally when Facebook began paying for egg freezing of their female employees in a bid to give them some perks and to encourage them to work longer for an age that they wanted to. And then this idea got worldwide publicity and some other big tech companies also pay for this. The idea is still new in India, but what I found out is that single career-minded women are thinking about it as an insurance against a declining quantity and quality of egg production, with the aim of having this option as this insurance of having a baby at a later date. Nishi, you will have to think through a lot of things like your own age and ability to manage a baby physically and financially the more you delay this decision. My conversation with Dr. Katyar was so interesting that I plan to invite her on the podcast very soon so she can go into details of the process. So please do send in your questions which you might have. Remember, our focus is money. So your questions should have more of a money connect than anything else. And Nishi from Mumbai, I hope you found this useful and you are in a better place to take this very crucial decision.
So this comes in from a couple from Gurgaon called Ritika and Somesh. Their question is, we're both professionals leading a super dink life in Gurgaon. Dink meaning double income, no kids. We're both in our early 30s and want to start a family. But the question of what it will cost and how will we manage our careers keeps stopping us from making this decision. We're sure we want a baby, but are just feeling afraid that we're unprepared both financially and with our career decisions.
Ritika and Somesh, this is one of the scariest decisions to take, isn't it? Both emotionally and financially and career-wise. For most people, you feel inadequate. The only thing I can tell you is that there is no perfect moment. There'll always be milestones to reach, net worth targets to achieve before that right moment arises. There isn't that right moment. You just have to jump in and swim this journey of parenthood. But let's look at some of these issues, especially around the costs. And we'll break it down into two parts. One is the cost to the career, and the other is what it costs to bring up the baby. Now, given the biological reality that it is the woman who carries the baby, it is true that many women face very tough career obstacles when they take this decision to have a baby. It'll depend on the company you work for and the career track that you envisage for yourself. And every family needs to take this decision as to what kind of help you're going to get and how you're going to manage your career once the baby comes around. The baby is fairly easy to handle during the pregnancy. But you know, it's once when they are born that you need to decide who the principal caregiver is going to be. And this can have cost implications. One option is that one of you takes a break in your career to bring up baby. It used to be unconditionally the woman who made that decision. But I'm hearing of families where the men are stepping up, offering to be the person at home looking after baby because the woman is in a very fast career track. Or she prefers to work, whereas he is okay to be at home. You know, so these are negotiations you have together as a couple. If this is the option you're toying with, that one of you gives up work to bring up baby, you must understand that moving from a two-income to a one-income family is a huge shift. It's a huge hit on your finances, on your savings. You'll have to work out the numbers to see if you can indeed afford it. What I can quickly add here is that this period of intensive care is about 5 to 6 years. So whichever partner steps out can very easily get back in as long as you keep a little bit of your career alive during the time of the parental leave that you might be considering. The second option is to involve the grandparents if you're lucky enough to have parents who live in the same city and are willing to look after the kids while you're at work. This really doesn't cost anything. It's the best case scenario for kids as they get grandparent love and you get to work and provide for their future. A third option is the nanny and the daycare route. Both cost money and both are viable options, and they both leave you free to work. Take a call on the trade-off between the cost of these services and the money that the lower-earning partner is bringing in to see if it makes sense. Not in India, but in some of the Western countries, when you do this cost-benefit, you realize that the cost of childcare is sometimes higher than what the parent earns. So this is a decision that has to be taken a lot depending on what it costs to get good services which make you feel both safe and confident that your child is being looked after. The next part of this question, what does it cost to bring them up? You know, what does your future look like? It can cost from very little to crores of rupees depending on who you are. A billionaire's kids will cost a lot because simply he and she can afford it. But the kids of an average middle-class family need not cost too much. In my experience and opinion, it's really the parents' decisions on branded clothes, toys, birthday parties, which typically end up costing a bomb. If you have a sensible feet on the ground approach to handling expenses, then you will handle theirs in a similar manner that you handle yours. It doesn't have to be any different. You don't have to pluck stars out of the sky for them. They will adjust to the life that you can provide. But the one thing that you need to start planning for and accumulating is the cost of higher education. This is a big one because the school fees comes out of your monthly budget. You have to rationalize your expectations on which school to be sending them to. It really has to fit into the budget that you have for yourself as you go along. This higher education can cost anything between 25 lakh to 2 to 8 crores. You know, the scale is very large. If you are sending them abroad, depends what country you are sending them to. Is it an undergraduate course? Is it a postgraduate? So it is a large amount of money and you will have to do the research to see about how much are you able to save and what is it that you are trying to target. And I'm going to give you a formula right now. Every 10 lakh rupees that you want to target in the future, right? I'll give you a number that you need to save today for that. And I'm assuming that you get a 12% average annual return on a low-cost index fund on either the Sensex or the Nifty 50. For every 10 lakh, suppose you have a 15-year horizon, you need to save 27,000 rupees a year. That's it. And if you have 20 years ahead of you, it is 14,000 rupees per 10 lakh. So you do the maths, you do the multiplication, and you will arrive at what your current savings for the next 15, 20 years needs to be able to send your child to this higher education. A little bit of tough love here. I will give you advice which normally you will not hear. Create this fund in your own name and gift it when that higher education goal is reached. Today, you have no idea what the next 15, 20 years looks like. You don't know what the child turns out to be. You have saved money for a goal that you think is desirable. But if your kid wants to buy cryptocurrency or any other Ponzi scheme which is in the market that time, you probably will not want to see this very hard-earned money, hard-saved money, go into some Ponzi scheme. So it's a good idea, one, not to discuss too much of how much you have saved for their higher education. A little bit of struggle is good. And two, invest in your own name the money that you are saving so that when that goal is reached, you're able to fund it. And while you're thinking about your children's future, please do not forget to put on your own money oxygen mask for your retirement. And you can use pretty much the same formula that I have given above to see how much you will need. So do a balance between what you want to spend on their education and how much money you need for your retirement. We all have limited means, okay? We don't have money which is unaccounted for. It is all tax-paid money. There is only so much limited amount available. So do a fair share between the kids and your retirement as well. Ritika and Somesh, I'm hoping that you took away three things from this. You need to plan ahead today as to who the principal caregiver for the child is going to be, because each of the decisions, each of the choices has a financial impact on your lives. Second, a kid will cost as much as you want to bring up. It can cost a lot because that's your decision. They're not demanding anything when they're babies, right? You're the ones giving it. It's our aspirations that get translated into things for the kids and expenses. Third, most importantly, you have to start saving regularly the moment the child is born for their future education. It's a goal that might cost a lot, but starting early, you will get there. And do tell the pod whether it's a boy or a girl.
This one is from Lok and Ambi from Pune, who are asking, we are a Pune-based couple in our mid-30s. We have two kids, one is 6 and the other is 2. We wanted to ask, what is a good time to begin educating the kids about money? We come from a conservative background, with the family money being mainly in gold, real estate, and deposits. Money was never discussed at home when we were growing up, and we learned many lessons the hard way. We want our kids to not be money-minded, but be money-smart. What is the right balance?
Lok and Ambi, what a lovely question, and it is something that I'm sure so many other listeners are going to resonate with. The money conversation in our homes in India is probably next only to the sex conversation. We do not include the children in the money talk, thinking that they are too young to talk about these things, to understand money. Somewhere we think that money is gross, it is evil, and we don't want to contaminate our children. We are doing our children a disservice not to include them in some basic facts about money. I think it's a great idea to involve children as young as 4 or 5 in very simple choices, in some money decisions which are relevant to them. And I'm going to tell you a small story from my own life. When my daughter was around 7 a long time ago, I took her to the market and I remember there was an old bookstore and a new bookstore. Obviously, you can buy many more old books for the same money than a new book. So I remember I gave her 2 choices. You have 200 rupees. You can buy 3 old books from this or 1 new book. And she remembers, I don't, that I spent a lot of time telling her that if she chose the new book, it was not a wrong choice. Because if you prefer to have this brand new book, which nobody else has used, that's okay. Or if she chose the 3 old books, that was also fine. So my idea was to sort of take away the moral judgment of any of the choices. She remembers choosing the quantity over the shiny new book. But, you know, it was her decision and she took ownership of the consequences of her decision. So in very simple ways, if you can explain to them why this is a choice which is available to them and how it impacts their lives in very small everyday stories. Another time, we were buying shoes and she wanted the expensive ones. And I reasoned that she would grow out of them in a year. It just made more sense to buy the less expensive ones, because she's not going to be using it for a very long time. So while comfort and all is the same, if it is going to cost more today, I would rather not do it. It is our explanations and our reasoning that will go down as lessons. It's the matter of fact, feet on the ground approach that is something that will stay with them and it will really drive their own money decisions as they grow. So you should try and do it at every opportunity. Let them, as they grow older, be part of family decisions. Whether you do a car upgrade today or go for a family holiday, we all have limited means. We have to do this choice. Is it a new gadget today or is it a larger education fund for them later? And lastly, Lok and Ambi, your kids will do as you do and not as you say. So if you are giving them money lessons and upgrading gadgets just because you want to, that's the messaging that they will see. So kids will do as you do, not as what you tell them to do. And that's a wrap for today. I enjoy answering your money questions. Remember, I don't look at individual portfolios. I don't recommend products. Look upon this space as a place to ask strategy questions, doubts, and just basic things that you might not understand. Each time you have a good money outcome, I feel that I have won. To make sure that you don't miss an episode, press follow and help your friends get money smart by sharing a link with them. You can reach out to me at mailme@monicahullin.com. That's Monica with a K. Tag my social media handles @MonicaHullin. And finally, remember that you should have money and money should not have you. So let's talk money again soon. Bye.
Let's Talk Money is hosted by Monica Hullin. This is a Made in India production. Creative Director, May Mariam Thomas. Project Manager, Sean Phantom. Head of Audio Production, Karthik Kulkarni. Producer, Meghna Gulati. Sound Editor, Sarthak Ray. Artwork Design by Alika Gupta.